Proceed to the fifth case, and Nisime versus Hewlett-Packard. Ms. Murchison.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Denise Murchison, and I represent the plaintiff appellant Sanjay Anasamy. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. We're here today because the trial court granted defendant's motion for summary judgment. I would like to address 5 different issues in turn. And at the end, I will ask the court to reverse the trial court's decision and reinstate Mr. Anasamy's claim. By the way of background, Sanjay Anasamy is a South Asian Indian male. He was born in India. He worked for Hewlett-Packard as a systems engineer on an H-1B visa. That means he's an immigrant. Anasamy worked for Hewlett-Packard from April 2001 to June 23, 2003. On appeal, Anasamy claims that he has sufficient evidence to go to a jury on his hostile work environment based on his national origin, pursuant to Title VII and Section 1981. We are also challenging the court's dismissal of Mr. Anasamy's retaliation claim, his Family Medical Leave Act claim, and his assault claim. First, I'd like to address the hostile work environment. Mr. Anasamy was subject to harassment that was so severe and pervasive. He suffered racially derogatory remarks from his supervisor, Ken Smith, and I will address that later. Ken Smith indeed was his supervisor.
Let me ask you this. Did he mention any of Smith's comments? I mean, did he tell the company what Smith said? I mean, he told them that he didn't get along with Smith, that they had problems, but these various statements that were made by Smith that were offensive statements, were those reported?
Anasamy did testify that he did talk to Russell Lewis, who is Mr. Smith's supervisor, and he thinks he mentioned the remark to him.
Thinks he
but
did.
But what's even more important, I'll deal with it now, is Smith was his supervisor. And when the individual who is making the environment hostile, is the supervisor, it is basically strict liability. Why do I say that Ken Smith was his supervisor? Even Russell Lewis referred to him as the site manager. In a remark that he made to the plaintiff, Mr. Anasamy, he said, "I got some resumes here. They've got Indian-sounding names. I'm going to reject them." What does that tell us? Smith had the ability to hire. If you look at the termination letter, who is it signed by? Who is it from? Ken Smith. Ken Smith was his supervisor. But even more importantly, Hewlett-Packard's policy states, let me find this here. According to HP's open door policy, the line manager, and Ken Smith was a line manager, engages HR for support and to find a solution, reviews all facts and determines appropriate level of action required for the situation, takes clear and decisive action, brings closure to issues, initiates disciplinary action consistent with company policy and practices warranted. So in the hierarchy of Hewlett-Packard, Ken Smith was a supervisor.
And the plaintiff never told Lewis, the site manager, or never went beyond, like he said, he thought he may have said something, but he never told anybody else at Hewlett-Packard that he believes.
He told Shelley Dropkin. In April of 2003, he had a conversation with Shelley Dropkin. He made an oral complaint. On May the 6th, 2003, that complaint was put into writing. And in that complaint, he states in so many words, "I'm treated like a servant because I'm an immigrant." Immigrant is synonymous with national origin. Under Title VII, we prohibit discrimination based on national origin, meaning you are from another nation. But I'd like to talk specifically about the remarks that the supervisor made that should show the court that his remarks were so severe and so hostile that the district court was wrong. Ken Smith said all of Asia should be smashed. Actually, he said all of Asia should be destroyed. And he stated India, Pakistan, Afghanistan. Now, it just so happens that Mr. Anasamy is from India. Well, you can well imagine if you were in another country and someone said New York, Chicago, and L.A., the U.S. should be destroyed, you know that you're dealing with an individual who is anti-U.S. Mr. Smith also said people out of college are not getting any jobs because people like Mr. Anasamy are taking their jobs. It's well known in the IT industry that there are we have H-1B visas because these individuals come from Asia. In 2002 and 2003, Smith said he would only consider resumes with American-sounding names. And there is an so these are the explicit statements that Ken Smith made that should tell the court that he was hostile toward Mr. Anasamy because he was Asian India. But the most explosive and the most intense incident happens to be when Mr. Anasamy was assaulted by his coworkers. Ken Smith, it was a setup. And the record shows that Ken Smith made a number of phone calls. Mr. Anasamy had to go to the workplace. While he was in the workplace, his coworker closed the door, took something like a gun, and smashed him up against the head. And he said, I'm going to finish you. And he called him a motherfucker and an Indian racist bastard. And then he left him there. And then Hans Sterling, his coworker, made phone calls to Ken Smith. That is sufficient evidence to present to a jury that Mr. Anasamy was the victim of racial or national origin discrimination. I would like to proceed to the retaliation. Are there any questions?
Well, I wanted to get back to the supervisor issue. In the Hall case, we had a situation where a supervisor exercised authority to direct the plaintiff operations, provided input into the charge with training the employee and other less experienced employees, found that that wasn't a supervisor. And in this situation, didn't have the power to hire or fire him, did he? I mean, I just want you to just tell me what's different about this situation than the Hall case.
Well, he definitely had the power to hire. As I said, he said to the plaintiff, I've got these resumes. Because they don't have American-sounding names, I'm going to reject them.
Well, maybe he was saying that, but the job description that you read from the podium just a few minutes ago didn't confer upon him hiring and firing authority. At least if it did, I missed it. So he may be bragging about it, but if he doesn't actually institutionally hold that authority, then he's not a supervisor under our case law. And I thought it was undisputed that he did not have that authority.
Well, it's not undisputed.
What evidence is there that he had that authority? Institutionally, other than this comment that you're referring to?
Beyond that comment, we do know from the record that Mr. Smith did have input into who was hired. But HR and Russell Lewis had the final say.
Exactly. And that gets back to Judge Williams' question.
Yeah, and that gets back to my point that Smith didn't have the authority to place him on probation or to terminate him or to make the ultimate decision. That was what I'm trying to get at. And in this Hall case, we had a situation similar because supervisors, I mean, one can be a supervisor. I mean, we're looking at our case law, but one can be a supervisor in sort of like that comment that he made. In his own mind, he's a supervisor and he has way more power than he really actually has from the company. So that's why I wanted you to try to distinguish between this Hall case, where in Hall there were a lot of little responsibilities that this person had over the plaintiff, but we found that it wasn't a supervisor under the Act. And that's sort of the rub here, I think.
No, actually, the difference between this case and Hall is it's in Hewlett-Packard's policy that HR is there to support the line manager. HR is there to support them. So the line manager is making the decisions, and HR is making sure that the supervisor follows their protocol. But the brains in this operation is the line manager. I see that my time is up. And
thank you, Ms. Richardson. Mr. Roach?
May it please the court, counsel. John Roach on behalf of the appellees. Your Honors, if I could pick up on the hostile work environment claim in the supervisor issue, I believe that Hall, as well as Velez, support the position that Hewlett-Packard and the appellees have asserted that Mr. Smith was not the supervisor. It is undisputed that Mr. Lewis made the ultimate decision to terminate the plaintiff in this matter. And based on the Hall decision, as well as Velez, where it was found that the fire commissioner had the ultimate authority to make the determination, it cannot be argued that Mr. Smith is the supervisor here. And Justice Williams, picking up on your question on whether he ever reported any of this, he admits he never reported any of the allegations he's now raised in his complaint to the HR that was investigating his matter. In fact, he testified, quote, I kind of just put the ones that were borderline, but there were ones like, you know, they were pretty heavy stuff, kind of like, you know, I kept it to myself, and I kept it to myself most of the time. When he was questioned further why he did not include those allegations that are the basis of his complaint when complaining to Human Resources, plaintiff stated he was, quote, waiting for HR to ask him about it. So the allegations he's now raised in this court, he never gave HR the opportunity to investigate, never raised those to the HR department. The second matter is whether or not the conduct in question was severe or pervasive enough. We think that the decision of the district court was correct in following the Metropolitan Life case and the allegations in there. The allegations in this case are very similar and should not be found to create a severe or pervasive hostile work environment. And there was a new allegation that plaintiff raised 2 years after the litigation was filed that Mr. Smith, an African-American, made a comment to him that all people from India should be hanged from trees like black people were hanged from trees. And there's a number of problems with that statement. The first and most important is that claim was not included in his EEOC charge. And we believe that the Hottenroth case considered a very similar claim. And if you do not include that claim in your charge with the EEOC, you're not giving them the opportunity to do their investigative and conciliatory roles, and you're also not putting the employer on notice of those claims. And we believe because of that allegation should not even be considered here.
That physical altercation, that was also not reported.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was not reported to Ms. He admits he did not report it to Mr. Smith, Mr. Lewis, or to HR. As for the retaliation claim, again, plaintiff did not include that retaliation claim in his EEOC charge. He did not check the box indicating that he was bringing a retaliation claim. And in addition, he actually filed a separate charge with the EEOC for retaliation. When he brought this lawsuit, he decided not to include that charge or that right to sue letter as part of his claim. Based on that, we do not believe that he can now bring his retaliation charge, and we believe that both McKenzie and Cheek support our position on that. We also do not believe that the plaintiff engaged in any statutorily protected activity. Although he did raise complaints about his manager, as we've noted, he never brought the allegations that he has raised here relating to his national origin. And the courts are clear that merely complaining in general terms of discrimination or harassment without indicating a connection to a protected class, providing facts sufficient to create that inference is insufficient. And that's a quote from Tom Nanovich. And all he did in this case was complain about his manager in general terms. He did not raise any of the claims that he's now raising relating to his national origin. In addition, in his retaliation claim, plaintiff hasn't offered anything to show a causal connection between his alleged statutorily protected activity and any adverse employment action. The performance review was initiated on May 5th, but as the testimony and is undisputed in this matter, the process had begun a month before that when Mr. Smith had contacted HR to start the process. Even under Mr. Andonsami's version of when he raised his complaints, it was all after that process was well underway, so there can't be any suspicious timing in relation to the performance warning. In addition, and as the Moser case set out, if an employee is called into question for unprofessional or insubordinate behavior, it alleviates any suspicious timing concerns that would be raised. If I could turn to the FMLA claim and just briefly want to make 2 points on that. One is the plaintiff did not suffer from a serious medical condition, and the second is the plaintiff failed to provide any notice to his employer. The plaintiff admits that he could perform his job functions at all time during the time period he claims he suffered from a serious medical condition. And the definition of a serious medical condition requires a period of incapacity. Without that period of incapacity, the plaintiff cannot show that he suffered from a serious medical condition. In addition to his own testimony, his treating physician testified that at no time did he put any restrictions on the plaintiff's work, nor did he find that the plaintiff couldn't perform the functions of his job. Without that, the plaintiff can't meet the essential element of establishing a serious medical condition. We also believe that plaintiff failed to provide any notice to HP. He admits he didn't provide any formal notice, but he claims that his change in behavior should have been some signal to the court. And as the courts have found in the circuit, the employer is not required to be clairvoyant. And recently in the DeLarma versus Illinois Department of Human Services, it's case number 071156, 2008 Westlaw 4052918, decided September 2nd by this court. The court noted that the employer does not have to be Sherlock Holmes and investigate any illnesses that an employee has. And specifically in that case, the employee had said because they had gone to the emergency room and from work, the employer should have been on some notice that they were suffering from a serious medical condition. And therefore, any time they called in sick, the employer should have been noticed. And the court said, quote, this argument does not wash. The FMLA does not require employers to play Sherlock Holmes, scanning an employee's work history for clues as to undisclosed true reason for an employee's absence. This is simply nothing in the record to suggest the kind of dramatic, observable change in DeLarama's work performance or physical condition that would excuse her from failing to notify the department of her need for FMLA leave. We believe the same is true here. There is nothing that would excuse the plaintiff from notifying Hewlett-Packard if he needed to take that medical leave. The assault claim, I believe our brief set out that in order to bring that assault claim and bring in a new party, the plaintiff would have had to have shown that he was mistaken as to the identity of the Ken Smith. It's clear he knew who Ken Smith was throughout this and just failed to bring him within the statutory period. I would be happy to address any questions from the panel. Thank you. We would request that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Roach. Ms. Murchison.
Okay. I would like to address the issue of whether Ken Smith was a supervisor. I was remiss in not mentioning this earlier. Because of Mr. Andonsami's H-1B visa status, it required Mr. Smith's signature to sign his immigration or H-1B visa. This is equivalent to hiring or rehiring authority, and I would ask the court to consider that.
And then, Ms. Murchison, do you have any cases that where the court looks at that kind of signature on that type of visa that says that that can be equivalent to supervisor?
No, I would say that's an issue of first impression.
Okay. All right.
I would just like to address, and I see that my time is running, FMLA issue. It's very clear from the record that Mr. Andonsami did have a serious medical condition. His doctor prescribed antidepressants. His behavior in the workplace is well documented. It was so alarming to the point that he was placed on administrative leave, basically banished, like the employee in Stevenson Higher. And under that case, the court has found that if an employee's behavior is so drastic, it's the burden is then on the employer to tell the employee of their FMLA rights. Hewlett Packard didn't do this. I would ask the court to reverse the decision of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Murchison. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.